We get things underway by welcoming to the program an acclaimed novelist, essayist, and television writer. She's the author of the memoir A Really Good Day and novels like Red Hook Road and Love and Treasure. Along with her husband, Michael Chabon, she'll be appearing at the Blue Hill Public Library this Friday night at 7 o'clock as part of WordFest. In conversation with Laura Miller, we are pleased to be joined this afternoon by Ayelet Waldman. Thank you so much for making some time for us today. We're delighted to have you back here. How much of the summer do you and Michael spend here in Maine?
Well, usually we come in July, and we've started staying through till sometime in November. So anywhere from 4 to 5 months.
Oh, excellent. Well, that makes you official Mainers then.
Does it, though? I don't think you can be official Mainers unless your grandparents were born here.
That may be true. I was born in Connecticut, lived there for all of 3 months, so I'm still not considered a native.
I think there you go. Well, or not.
Let's talk about what's happening on Friday night at the Blue Hill Public Library. You and your husband, Michael Chabon, participating in the Word Festival. And you'll be talking with Laura Miller of Slate about writing for television. Tell us more about that.
Well, Michael and I have been writing for television together for quite some time. I would say probably, I want to say 6 years, 7 years. And before that, I began writing on my own for television. And it's a wonderful thing that we enjoy doing together. We certainly wouldn't write our novels or nonfiction together, but this screenwriting is a very collaborative process. So we've really enjoyed writing together. We've done it on Unbelievable, which aired on Netflix, a TV show that I began, but brought him in on, and we've done it on Star Trek Picard, a TV show that he brought me in on. So, and now we just finished 8 scripts for a show on Netflix. We hope it's up to them right now, based on The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, Michael's Pulitzer Prize winning novel.
Well, let's go back a little bit because we're big fans of Picard here. How is that? Does it create an additional challenge as writers to work with existing characters?
Well, I think for Michael, you know, Michael was such a huge Trek fan, just crazy, you know, as much of a fan as it is possible to be, which is a lot. So for him, it was, you know, the dream of a lifetime to create canon for a show that he loves so much. I actually think it's easier in its way. I mean, you know, coming up with stories that don't betray the characters is challenging. I wasn't involved in that part of the Picard process. I just came on at the end and was there on set, and then also helped Michael with 1 script, the 9th, I believe. But it's actually, you know, it's fun, especially when you have an actor, a talented actor, because then you're writing with someone's voice in your head. And you know their range, and you know what they can do, and it's actually kind of exhilarating to be in that position.
You've written novels, essays, nonfiction work as well. How does writing for TV differ, and does it tap into a different part of your skill set?
Well, the most important way that it differs is that it's not so lonely. You know, writing fiction especially is lonely business. It's just you and a computer and maybe a stack full of research materials. But mostly it's you and the empty screen. So that takes a certain kind of discipline and a certain kind of fortitude. What's exciting for me about television is that it's a collaborative process, you know, not just in terms of Michael and me that we write together, but there are, you know, executives involved. And then once you make the show, you have these brilliant people with incredible talent that do completely different things from you. So you have directors and you have production designers and you have costume designers and actors, and your job in television, this isn't necessarily true in film where the writer takes a back seat, but in television where the writer is kind of in charge, your job is to marshal the talents of all of these disparate individuals and have everybody pulling in the same direction to make something magnificent with the, you know, everyone doing the best work they possibly can. And that's really an exciting process to witness and be part of.
We're talking with Ayelet Waldman here on Downtown. I have to think too, that especially writing for episodic television gives you a wonderful opportunity to develop characters in a way that, well, you couldn't in a novel and certainly not for a film.
Well, I actually think that it is very similar to novel writing. So, you know, a novel is this big project that has lots of scope. And a television series, especially the kinds of series I do, which are limited series, they don't go on for years and years, that is novelistic in form because it allows you this big canvas on which to, you know, have many characters, not just your one point of view character, and to really dig into multiple storylines. So that is a muscle that is actually more similar to novel writing, I think, than it is to screenwriting. I've written film as well, and there you really do have a very narrow canvas.
We're in a new golden age of television in many ways, and I'm old enough to remember a time when even actors who were film actors wouldn't appear on television. That was
right.
Somehow beneath them. These days, they flock to television. There are seemingly more opportunities there. And I wonder if that's the case for writers as well. There are so many writers who have been successful in other mediums who have come to television because of the opportunities that are presented there.
Well, yes, but also because of the health insurance. So, you know, like if you're a novelist, you don't have any health insurance. And in this country, you get sick, you go bankrupt. Mm. So, I mean, that can happen to you with health insurance, unfortunately, but, you know, especially if you're uninsured, and there really is no way for help for, you know, up until Obamacare, there was no way for a writer to get health insurance. So when we started in this business, it was purely for the health insurance. We needed to figure, we had all these children and we needed to figure out a way to get insured in an affordable manner. And we thought, all right, we'll start writing for TV or film. And then the Writers Guild, the Union of Screenwriters, will insure us. And for years, that was our primary motivation. And then I began to really enjoy the process. And sorry, my dog's barking. And Michael began to really enjoy the process. And then it became more of a labor of love than a purely practical matter. But from the, at the beginning, we just had to figure out a way to get what, you know, everybody else in the world gets without having to think about their job.
Let's talk a bit, if we can, about the adaptation of Cavalier and Clay, a book that so many people have loved through the years. What kind of challenge does that pose for a book that so many people have read and feel a personal connection and investment with?
Well, it is a real obligation. You know, you have to, it's a tremendous responsibility. There are all of these people and they have very high expectations, as they should. So, you know, we have to tread carefully. And, you know, because it's Michael's material, he feels very free to change things. So the things we do change were, you know, we are ready to defend. And I think we've made it into its own piece of art, separate from the novel, but still it's very clearly an adaptation of the novel. But yeah, we operate with this clear consciousness that there are millions upon millions upon millions of people around the world who love this book and for whom it's very important. And we don't want to betray them. And then there are also lots and lots of people who haven't read it, who we want to introduce the material to. And maybe once they watch the show, they will go out and read it. That would be awesome.
What's the state of the publishing world these days? In many ways, it seems like there might be more opportunities for people to get their work out there to the eyes of readers, but can things also get lost in the shuffle?
Yeah, I think, you know, I personally am someone who appreciates a gatekeeper. I know that sounds kind of awful, but I read a tremendous amount and I just don't. But even so, I don't have time to read everything. And so what I like to know that there was an editor who sort of said, oh, this is a book that's, you know, that's excellent and worth your time. And so then I'm a little more confident when I invest my money and my time in something. So I don't actually read very often self-published books, which I'm, you know, there are lots of books that are amazing that are self-published. It's just, I if I had all the time in the world, I would probably explore that medium. But right now I have to, you know, I don't have enough time to read as it is. So I make sure that, you know, I actually like to know the editor on a book and say, oh, you know, that person shares my taste. So if they are publishing this book, that's a good sign that I'm going to like it.
Do you still encounter people who are shocked that you had the effrontery to suggest that perhaps you loved your husband more than your children?
Not as much anymore. You know, I think there's really been a shift in our attitudes toward the sort of preciousness of motherhood. but and people are more and more conscious that, you know, you have to have a balanced approach. But sure, there are definitely people who are still horrified by that. You know, it was always very comforting to me. I went on a Salt Lake City radio show because the Mormons really like that idea. You know, centering your relationship is incredibly important to lots of religious people. So I found myself getting support from ministers and temple leaders and even priests. So that was nice. You know, my kids are all grown now. My youngest is 19. So I kind of think the proof is in the pudding, where they're very close to each other and to us. And if I personally had any ambivalence about how I prioritized my myself during their childhood, I think the fact that they're all, you know, knock on wood, doing well and happy, and my oldest two are in really wonderful relationships. My daughter's getting married at the end of the summer. I feel like I'm good. But sure, I bet there are people who would still like to send me a hate-filled email. But the world is full. You know, right now, hate-filled emails are a dime a dozen. I can't really get upset about those.
I have a good friend in the theater world who has a number of times produced plays behind the walls of prisons, primarily in New York State. I wonder, what was your experience, and what did you learn in editing inside this place, not of it?
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up. That's a book that I'm really, really proud of. So this was a book where we sent interviewers to women's prisons all around the country and then brought back these very long first-person narratives transcribed of these women's experiences in prison and before, and also insight into their lives. And then I took those long narratives and sort of crafted a shortened and structured version that was still in the women's voice and that was, they felt, was an accurate representation of their words. But that kind of showed the challenges and injustices inherent in the prison system. And, you know, I learned a tremendous amount. I learned that in women's prison, unlike in men's prison, the people who perpetrated the violence were by and large the guards. The women were remarkably supportive of one another, remarkably helpful to one another. There was very little prisoner upon prisoner violence. On the contrary, they were an incredible support system, helping women who had psychiatric illnesses, helping women who had physical illnesses, helping women with addiction and emotional support. So I was really, it gave me great hope to see what happens when a group of women from really different backgrounds get together in a system that really is designed to make them miserable and make them suffer. And how they gather and support one another was really admirable and touching.
You and Michael collaborated on a history of the American Civil Liberties Union. What do you see as the role of the ACLU these days when it seems that our civil liberties are in more jeopardy than they've been in quite some time?
Yeah. I mean, I think the ACLU and organizations like it are the thin blue line. I don't know about you, but I never expected to live in an America where basic rights like, you know, the right to vote, the right to abortion would be so profoundly threatened. I mean, you know, in half of this country now, you can be prosecuted for having an early abortion. In half of this country now, there are rules that say that a physician can't terminate a pregnancy even if a mother is dying. So I think what people don't know is that there are many states that don't have life of the mother exceptions even, and that we're shifting more and more towards that. So I think the ACLU is, I am grateful to them for their advocacy. They're the reason, you know, they represented Obergefell, and they're the reason that we have gay marriage, which is so wonderful and such a huge part of how our country has developed and grown over the past decades. But I'm a pretty pessimistic person by nature, and I am I am saddened by what's happened to democracy in this country. You know, I was a law student and lawyer, and what I loved about the United States Constitution was its elasticity, the fact that it could, that a document created by slave owners could become this shining beacon of democracy and equality around the world. And it makes me so sad that right now we live in a country where half of the population doesn't seem to think that, you know, small d democracy is important, and that spouts authoritarian rhetoric and lies with impunity. And I don't know. I mean, you know, I'm an immigrant. My parents are from Canada, though my mom was born in the United States, which is how I have my passport. I was born in Israel. But, you know, like many immigrants, we came to this country with so much optimism and hope. And to see us grow into this kind of vicious, stagnant, anti-democratic society makes me so sad.
So is there a role for the arts in helping us find our way out of this mess?
You know, I hope so. The way I think about this is, I don't know that art can cure the kind of violence that we see so prevalent in America. You know, I feel like every time I open the newspaper, there's another mass shooting. I don't think it can cure the kind of hatred we see when some large number, you know, majority of the Republican Party believes these lunatic fantasies about QAnon, that there's some, you know, I don't even want to go into what the fantasies are. But I do think art can provide hope to those who struggle to make a better society. So I think art can be inspirational, and it can be comforting, and it can also be a warning. And to those who are in the battle, you know, who have entered the arena and aren't afraid to fight for what they believe, art can be a solace.
Ayelet Waldman and Michael Chabon will be appearing Friday night at the Blue Hill Public Library in conversation with Laura Miller. You can get more information and register by going to wordfestival.org or calling 374-5632. Ayelet, thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you. I love radio. It's my favorite medium.
Well, I hope we can do it again sometime. Thanks again.
Great. Thanks. Bye.